Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two Christmas stories by Mary E. Wilkins Freeman, The Christmas Ghost and The Christmas Masquerade. She wrote several stories about Christmas. It was hard to choose which ones to read for you. Might have to add an extra episode for the season. Staying safe and cozy in your homes this year might be difficult. I hope these charming stories will make it a little easier. And now, The Christmas Ghost by Mary E. Wilkins Freeman. In front of Jane White's house, roared and surged, beating the rocky shores with unfailing tides, the great Atlantic. The waves floating an occasional fishing vessel were all that passed before her front windows. From gazing all her life at such stern and mighty passers, the woman's face had gotten a look of inflexible peace. Jane White looked as if she would always do her duty, but as if she would spare neither herself nor her friends if they came in the way, as if nothing could interpose between herself and her high tide mark, not even her own happiness nor that of others. She was not an old woman, but she seemed to have settled into that stability of old age which comes before the final greatest change of all. Her days were absolutely monotonous. She lived alone. She kept her house in order. She made her simple garments. Always on Saturdays she harnessed her horse into the wagon and drove to the village, 3 miles away, for groceries. On Sundays she drove as regularly to church. These simple excursions, for bodily and spiritual food, were all that brightened her life. There were only two houses near hers. In one of them lived a bedridden old woman and her elderly son and daughter. In the other, David Gleason. The bedridden old woman and the son and daughter had not been on friendly terms with Jane for years, and they had not entered each other's houses. Sometimes Jane used to look down the road to the gray slant of the riding house, rising out of the hollow with a scowl of dissent. She could hate with vigor, in spite of the severe peace of her expression. There was a mighty grudge between them. Once the son, Thomas Riding, had paid attention to Jane White. That was in her mother's day. And Thomas's mother and sister had interfered and broken off the match. They had told stories as to Jane's temper and poor housekeeping, and the young man had believed them. He had ceased courting Jane, and she knew the reason. Once afterward, coming home from church, she had stopped her wagon in the narrow, sandy road beside the riding team, and taxed the mother and sister with it openly. Thomas had been driving his old gray horse. His mother and sister sat one on each side of him. That was before the old woman got the hurt which laid her up for life. Jane's mother sat at her left, quivering with resentment. She had been a wiry little woman with a fierce temper. "Whoa," said Jane to her horse. Then she spoke out her mind once for all to Sarah Riding and her mother. "I know just what you've said about me. You needn't think I don't," said she. "And it's all lies, every word of it," said her mother in a panting voice. "We've got ears, and we've heard the loud talking when the windows were open and the wind our way," Sarah Riding had replied, with a vicious click of thin lips. Sarah Riding was pretty, with a hard, sharp prettiness. "And we've seen the clothes on the line," said her mother. Mrs. Riding wore a false front, and that and her bonnet were grotesquely twisted to one side. "We ain't never had a word in our family betwixt us, and as for our clothes, I'd be ashamed to hang such looking things as yours be out on the line," panted Jane's mother. "We've got eyes and we've got ears," repeated Sarah Riding. "Then I should advise your mother to look in the glass when you get home, and set her wig and her bonnet straight," said Jane's mother unexpectedly. "Don't, mother," whispered Jane. Then she shouted glang to her horse, as did Thomas Riding to his, but Jane passed him. Thomas had not spoke a word during the whole. He left the talking to the women. He had sat still, with his rather clumsy, good-humored face fixed on his horse's ears. He was a little flushed, Otherwise, he showed no sign of agitation. "Thomas Riding is dreadful, wouldn't he, anyhow? You ain't missed much," Jane's mother had observed as they sped along the sandy road. Once she looked back and saw with that glee over petty revenge which is often seen in an old woman who has lived a narrow life, old Mrs. Riding trying to straighten her front piece and her bonnet, which was trimmed with tall, nodding purple flowers.
"She'd better talk," said she. "She'd better get on her own bonnet and wig straight before she talks about other folks not being neat."
"I most wish you hadn't said that," said Jane.
"Why not, I'd like to know?"
"I wish you hadn't. It didn't have anything to do with it. It's like sticking in pins when folks have come at you with hammers."
"I hope you ain't going to get cracked because Thomas Riding has jilted you," said her mother sharply.
Jane laughed. "I ain't one of the kind to be cracked," said she. And she spoke the truth. She had taken the young man's attentions as a matter of course, very much as she had always taken the unfolding of the leaves in the spring. This was something which came to most women, and it seemed to be coming to her. When she saw that she was mistaken, she had no more thought of questioning the justice of it than she would have done if a cloud which promised rain had cleared away to fair weather, or the bush which budded last spring had failed to do so this. Matters of that kind she relegated entirely to a higher power, and it was the easier for her to do so, since Thomas Riding was not a young man to awaken easily any girl's imagination. He was such a solid, incontrovertible fact of clumsy flesh and blood and slowly, steadily working brain that he could arouse only observation and acquiescence, never dreams. Jane was fully alive to the humiliation of being jilted, and wrathful as to the interference of Thomas's sister and mother, but in reality, that and the stigma cast upon her temper and neatness hurt her more at the time than the cessation of the young man's nightly visits. Even afterward, the clothes which flaunted from the white line shone like garments of righteousness, as indeed they had done before. Jane White's little domicile fairly shone with cleanliness, as did her person. Not a hair was out of place on her head. She was clean as one of the wave-washed petals on the beach. As for her temper, her mother died soon afterward, and there was no one for her to attack with a loud tongue, as she had been accused of doing, unless indeed she attacked that hard providence in whose shaping of her destiny she believed. She was absolutely alone from one week's end to the other, since she and the Ridings never exchanged calls, and as for David Gleason, he was a single man, and many said, an underwit, and he kept to himself, and never went into another house than his own, and Jane clearly could not call upon him. He was a small, fair-haired man who had come to the place and built his little shack some 10 years ago. Nobody knew from whence he came, nor anything about him. He seemed to be quiet and peaceable, and to have enough money for his simple needs, and the stigma of the underwit had somehow attached itself to him from his secrecy. People argued that a man would be likely to tell something to his credit, if there was anything to tell, and as nobody could imagine him to be a criminal with such a physiognomy, they concluded that he must be lacking in his intellects. He was commonly said to be love-cracked. Sometimes Jane used to see this man going down the road, moving with a gentle shuffle and slight stoop, and wonder if he were love-cracked. Now and then she felt inclined to ask him to ride, when she passed him on the way to church. He kept no horse, but she never did. The man used to look after her, sitting up straight in her wagon and disappearing between the scrubby pines of the coast country, with admiration, as any man might have done. The red coil of hair on the back of her head gleamed under her bonnet like a mat of red gold. She held her head and shoulders superbly. She was, in fact, a very handsome woman. The severe repose of her face had kept wrinkles at bay, and she had one of those rare complexions which the sea air does not tan and seam and harden, but awakens to life and rosy color. People used to say that there wasn't a young girl that went to church who was any handsomer than Jane White. Still, she had never had an opportunity to marry since Thomas Riding deserted her. Everybody, in fact, believed her to be a slovenly housekeeper and to have a bad temper. A fire of scandal is a hard thing to stamp out, as the sparks fly wide and kindle afar. Jane lived alone with a sort of rigid acquiescence to the will of the Lord and a smoldering hatred of the human instruments who had brought it to pass. In spite of her severe calm of demeanor, she had the natural weaknesses and longings of her kind. There were times, as the years went on, when she longed for Thomas Riding to come again, as she had never longed at first. She was often afraid alone in her house, especially in the winter time. She confessed her fears to no one, hardly to herself. "What good does it do to be afraid? I know I've got to live alone, and there's no way out of it," she said. "I might as well get over it first as last." But she never was able to conquer her nervous fears. Often, when the murmur of the waves on the shingle below the bank on which the house stood arose to a roar, and the winter wind was shaking the walls, this lonely human soul in the midst of it would light her candle and peer about the house for the evil which she seemed to feel to be present. Then she would extinguish her candle and, shading her eyes, press her face close to the window. But she could see nothing except the wild drive of the storm outside. Then the saying in the Bible about the prince of the powers of the air would come to her mind, and if she had been a Catholic, she would have crossed herself. A vague fear, which was none the less terrible because it was vague, seemed to hold her as in a vice. However, Jane White's health, in spite of her sensitive nerves, was superb. She had never an ache nor ail until 2 days before Christmas, 10 years after her mother died. Then she had a sudden attack of rheumatism after a spell of damp, warm, unseasonable weather. It was all she could do to hobble about the house. When it came to going to the well water, she thought at first she could never manage it. Finally she succeeded, fairly hitching herself over the ground one step at a time. She thought of having the doctor, but she had no one to send for him, unless she could waylay someone passing. Both the Riding and the Gleason houses were out of hailing distance, and had they not been, she would not have asked any of the dwellers therein to go for the doctor, unless it had been David Gleason. She thought that she might ask him if he were seen going by. He looked good-natured. But she did not see him nor anyone passing that day. It was midwinter, and toward noon the snow began to fall. The lonely woman thought dejectedly that she didn't know what she was going to do. The stitch in her back was no better. She had no remedies to apply to it. She saw no likelihood of getting a doctor. It was much as ever she could do to keep up with her fire and make herself a cup of tea at nightfall. A sense of utter loneliness, which was fairly desolate, smote her as she sat alone that evening. She heard the wind roar and the waves break, and the dash of the sleet on the window. She seemed to herself loneliness personified, one little human spark in the midst of an infinity of space and storm. At 9 o'clock, she went to bed. She slept upstairs. She had left the little bedroom on the first floor since her mother died. Her chamber was icy cold. She had heated a soapstone, and she rolled herself in an old flannel blanket and clambered into bed with groans of pain. It was a long time before she went to sleep. Then she slept soundly for a few hours. It was perhaps 4 o'clock when she awoke with a shock of deadly terror. She knew someone was in the house. She was no longer suspicious that someone was in the house. This time she knew. The storm was still howling outside. She could hear the constant surge of the ocean and the small drive of the sleet on the window. The room was absolutely dark. It must be still far from the winter dawn. She was sure that there was someone in the house. She reached out for the matches which she always kept on the table beside her bed, and as she did so, a cramp of pain seized her from the rheumatism. She nearly screamed, and the matches were gone. She usually moved them from the mantel shelf when she went to bed, but she must have omitted to do so. It had been so difficult for her to get about the night before. Jane endeavored to rise. She thought she would grope her way across the room to the shelf and get the matches, but the pain in her back was so great that she dare not make the attempt. She said to herself, what if she should fall and break a bone out there in the dark? It seemed to her that she was safer in the bed.
So she lay still, listening fearfully. She became more and more convinced that there was somebody in the house. She heard movements, soft and guarded but plainly evident to a sharp ear, below. Once or twice she was sure that she heard a door open and shut. Later on she heard the pump out in the yard, which had a peculiar creak. She lay bathed in a cold sweat of terror, expecting every moment to hear steps on the stairs. And presently the first cold glimmer of dawn was in the room, and she heard a door shut below. Then she heard nothing more. Everything was still. It was late before Jane succeeded in dragging herself up, with groans and frequent pauses, and getting dressed and downstairs. She felt convinced that the visitor, whoever he was, had gone. But she thought of her mother's silver teaspoons, and the clock, and a gold watch which had belonged to her father and would not go, but was still an impressive gold watch, and very dear to her. And she thought of her table linen and everything which was of value, for she had no doubt that the visitor was a thief. But when she reached the kitchen, moving by slow and painful stages, she gasped and stared again. A bright fire was burning in the stove. She had wondered if she could, by any possibility, make a fire with those panes like screwing knives in her back and shoulders. And the table was laid for breakfast, and the room was full of the aroma of coffee, for the pot was on the stove, and a pan of something covered with a towel stood on the back. And when she took off the towel, fearfully, there were fresh biscuits. Then a nice little bit of beefsteak was in the frying pan, all ready to cook, and the tea kettle was full of hot water, and the water pail in the sink was full. Outside, the storm was still raging, but the kitchen seemed like a little oasis of warmth and comfort in the midst of it. Even the geraniums in the south window had been watered. She heard the cat mew and opened the cellar door. The cat had been out when she went to bed, for she had called her in vain. Somebody had let the cat in and put her down cellar, lest she steal the beefsteak. "Who let you in?" said Jane, feebly, to the cat. She looked at the beefsteak and at the biscuits, doubtfully, as if they might be fairy food and have some uncanny property of harm. "I was out of meat, and today's Saturday, and I couldn't have gone down to the store," said she. "And I didn't have a mite of bread mixed, and I don't know how I could have done it." Finally, Jane cooked the beefsteak, poured out a cup of coffee, and ate her breakfast, though it was still with an unreasoning terror. It seemed a kindly deed, and yet it was so unexplained that it struck her with all the horror of the unusual. She ate suspiciously, almost as if she thought the food were poisoned. When she crept into the pantry to put away the dishes, she had another surprise, for she found on the shelf a little roasting piece, two pies, two loaves of bread, a piece of squash cut ready to boil, and some washed potatoes. Jane looked at them, white as ashes. "My land," said she. She staggered back to the warm kitchen, sat down, and reflected. She tried to think who could have done it, but she was entirely at a loss. For a moment she had a wild idea of Thomas writing in his old love for her, then she dismissed it. "He'd never get round to it," she said to herself. Then she thought of David Gleason, to dismiss that more promptly than the other. "There ain't anybody in creation who would do anything like this for me, and what's more, there wasn't anybody knew I had the rheumatism and couldn't do it myself," she argued. She gave it up. She roasted her meat and cooked the squash and potatoes and remained alone all day. The storm continued until sunset. Then, when the west was a clear, pale gold, the flakes stopped falling, and the earth looked like a white ocean, frozen suddenly in the midst of a tumult of rage. As for the real ocean, she could hear the boom of that louder than ever, for its fury does not subside so quickly as that of the earth. It cleared off very cold. Jane heaped her stove with wood when she went to bed. She burned wood from her own woodland, but she feared it would not last until morning, and she feared that she could not get downstairs to replenish it. As night came on, her rheumatism was worse,
and then her fears arose to such a pitch that, had it not been for the cold and her illness, she would actually have gone over to the Ridings. She went to bed, and lay quaking with sheer terror for some time. At last, all was still, and she fell asleep, to awaken as she had done the night before, at the sounds below. This time her matches were in reach. She struck one and lighted a candle. Then she pulled up the blanket with painful efforts and wrapped it around her. Then she crept out of bed. Along with the woman's timidity was a spirit of investigation. Had she been a man, she would have been afraid enough to make an excellent soldier. The battle would have been for her the only method of ridding herself of her panic. She could never have borne to cower behind breastworks. She crawled downstairs, feeling as if she were a stiff lay figure instead of herself. She planted her feet rigidly, as if they were wood. Every step was agony, but she kept on. At that moment, she was more terrified, if anything, to confront the stranger, because he had conferred benefits upon her than if he had worked her harm. It would not have seemed so uncanny. In spite of her religious training, the thought of the supernatural was strong in the woman's mind. She thought of her mother, of her father. How they would have felt to know she was all alone, sick with rheumatism in the winter storm, and God knew what she thought next. When she opened the kitchen door, her face was ghastly, peering over her candle. The kitchen was lighted, the fire burning, she smelled coffee. It was later than she had thought, 5 o'clock in the morning. She had only a vision of a figure swiftly moving out of sight into the pantry. Then she sprang with a stab of pain to the pantry door and shot the bolt. She had a bolt on the pantry door, because the pantry window had no fastening, but she had never used it. After she fastened it, she heard the person who she had locked in trying to open that window, and said to herself grimly that he could not do it. The north window must be frozen down so hard that it would be impossible to stir it without hot water. The man, whoever he was, she was sure it was a man, there had been no flirt of feminine skirts on that flying figure, must have come in through the cellar. The bulkhead had never been locked, for Jane and her mother, reasoning with the innocent fatuity of some women, had always said, "Nobody will ever think of coming through the cellar." The person whom Jane had locked in the pantry did not pound or try to get out. Finally, she took the carving knife from the table. He had been slicing some sausage for her breakfast, apparently, and she went to the pantry door and leaned her head toward it, curving her body at a careful distance. "Who be you?" said she. There was no response. Then she spoke again. "Who be you?" "A well-wisher," came in a feeble voice from the pantry. Then a cold shiver ran again over the woman. Again the supernatural terror reasserted itself. It was much more alarming that a well-wisher should come to her house and do these kindly deeds for her on this wicked earth the night before Christmas. She remembered with an additional shiver that Christmas Day was dawning. Then a burglar. She went over to the kitchen door and stood there, all ready to run should the person in the pantry make a motion to escape. She kept her eyes riveted on the pantry door. She made up her mind that as soon as it was light enough, she would go for the Ridings, no matter how they treated her in times gone by. It seemed to her that the full day would never come. But at last the light broadened and deepened over the blue hollows and white crests of snow. And then she saw that a nice path was dug from her door to the well. "My land," said she. She took a shawl off the peg, wrapped it around her, putting one corner over her head, succeeded, after many painful efforts, to get into her rubbers, and was about to set out when she caught a glimpse of a man's figure driving down the road. It was David Gleason, going for his milk, which he got from a farmhouse 2 miles toward the village. Jane crept out in the yard a little way and called. He heard her and came shuffling toward her in a light spray of snow. He had a mild, pleasant face, but Jane, after the prevalent report as to the state of his intellects, felt a little afraid to ask him into the house. "You go to the Ridings and ask Sarah and Thomas to come right over here as fast as they can," said she. She was almost crying. David Gleason looked at her anxiously.
"Anything the trouble? Anything I can do?"
he began, but she interrupted him. "Go as quickly as you can," said she. She was almost hysterical. It seemed to her an age before she saw David Gleason plod into the writing house, and presently he and Sarah, not Thomas, emerge. "Where in the world is Thomas?" she thought. "What good can a woman do?" She was glad to see Gleason returning with Sarah. She thought she would not be afraid of Gleason if Sarah were with him, and nobody knew what was in the pantry. Jane met them at the door. Suddenly, her rheumatism seemed better. She moved quite easily. Sarah Riding looked at her half-alarmed, half-indignant.
"What is the matter, Jane White?" said she.
"There's something in the house," replied Jane in an awful voice, and the other woman turned pale.
"What do you mean?"
"There's something in the house. It came last night and made up the fire and got breakfast and got the water and brought roast meat and bread, and it came again tonight, and I came down and I locked it in the pantry."
"Did you see it?"
asked Sarah, quivering. She grasped Jane's arm hard. The two old enemies fairly clung together, drawn by mutual terror. But David Gleason went close to the pantry door.
"It wasn't a woman, I know that," gasped Jane.
"Who's in there?"
cried David Gleason. There was no reply.
"It told me once it was a well-wisher," said Jane,
and Sarah Riding trembled like a leaf. The reply struck her as much as it had done Jane. Well-wishers abroad in the deadly cold of winter morning might well arouse terror.
Oh dear, I wish Thomas was here," cried Sarah. "I couldn't find him nowheres. I don't know, but something has got him. Oh, dear!"
"Who's in there?"
demanded David Gleason. He had a firm voice for such a small, slight man. "He ain't any more half-wit than I be," thought Sarah Riding. Then the voice replied again, but with a trifle more emphasis.
"A well-wisher."
Both women started.
"It's Thomas!"
cried Sarah Riding. Then she flew to the pantry door and unbolted it.
"Thomas Riding, what you be doing here?" she demanded. "Be you gone crazy?"
Thomas Riding, emerging from the cold blue depths of the frozen pantry, looked at once shamefaced and self-assertive.
"You needn't say a word, Sarah," said he. "I saw her having such hard work to get out to the well yesterday morning, and I knew she'd got the rheumatism. And when the storm begun and I thought of her all alone over here, I couldn't stand it, and—"
he went on, his voice gathering firmness in spite of an agitation which made him tremble from head to foot.
I know it was all a lie you and Mother told about her not being a good housekeeper. There it was, neat as wax here, and she laid up with the rheumatism, too. And as for her bad temper— anybody that can get around at all with the rheumatism and not say anything to be sorry for hasn't got much temper. And I wouldn't have minded one mite if she had."
"I should think you'd gone crazy," said Sarah scornfully, and yet her voice softened.
Thomas looked pitifully at Jane.
"It don't seem as if I could stand having you live here alone any longer,"
he said brokenly, as if his unhappiness over her loneliness were the only thing to be considered. It was the refinement of masculine selfishness. But Jane liked it.
"I didn't know you thought so much of me, Thomas," said she.
Then her face flamed.
"Well, I haven't got anything to say. You must suit yourself," Sarah said, still in that softened voice.
Then she and Gleason went out. Thomas Riding approached Jane and put his arm around her.
"Ain't you been afraid here all alone?"
said he.
"Yes, I have, but I didn't suppose you cared."
"I did," said he. "There's no use raking up bygones, but I know I've treated you mean."
"Yes, you have," admitted Jane impartially, but her eyes upon his face were tender.
"Wasn't so much because I was afraid you were bad housekeeper and bad-tempered. I didn't believe it, and I wouldn't have minded if you had been. But I backed out because Mother and Sarah felt so. I guess Mother will feel different now. But I can't help it if she don't. As for Sarah, Can't help it either. You ain't going to be left alone here any longer. How's your rheumatism, Jane?
I guess it's better. I haven't thought of it, replied Jane.
Then the outer door opened suddenly, and Sarah Riding looked in. David Gleason's face showed over her shoulder.
We wish you a Merry Christmas, said Sarah.
Her thin, pretty face was quite transformed by a sudden triumph of the best within her. The man behind her beamed with friendliness toward these people, who were nothing to him. It was suddenly borne in upon the consciousness of Jane White that love and kindness were not such strangers upon the earth as she had thought. And now, the Christmas Masquerade. On Christmas Eve, the mayor's stately mansion presented a beautiful appearance. There were rows of different colored wax candles burning in every window, and beyond them one could see the chandeliers of gold and crystal blazing with light. The fiddles were squeaking merrily, and lovely little forms flew past the windows in time to the music. There were gorgeous carpets laid from the door to the street, and carriages were constantly arriving, and fresh guests tripped over them. They were all children. The mayor was giving a Christmas masquerade tonight to all the children in the city, the poor as well as the rich. The preparation for this ball had been making an immense sensation for the last 3 months. Placards had been up in the most conspicuous points in the city, and all the daily newspapers had had at least a column devoted to it, headed with "The Mayor's Christmas Masquerade" in very large letters. The mayor had promised to defray the expenses of all the poor children whose parents were unable to do so, and the bills for their costumes were directed to be sent in to him. Of course, there was great excitement among the regular costumers of the city, and they all resolved to vie with one another in being most popular and the best patronized on this gala occasion. But the placards and the notices had not been out a week before a new costumer appeared who cast all the others into the shade directly. He set up his shop on the corner of one of the principal streets and hung up his beautiful costumes in the windows. He was a little fellow, not much bigger than a boy of 10. His cheeks were as red as roses, and he had on a long, curly wig as white as snow. He wore a suit of crimson velvet knee breeches and a little swallow-tailed coat with beautiful golden buttons. Deep lace ruffles fell over his slender white hands, and he wore elegant knee buckles of glittering stones. He sat on a high stool behind his counter and served his customers himself. He kept no clerk. It did not take the children long to discover what beautiful things he had and how superior he was to the other customers, and they began to flock to his shop immediately, from the mayor's daughter to the poor rag-pickers. The children were to select their own costumes. The mayor had stipulated that. It was to be a children's ball in every sense of the word. So they decided to be fairies and shepherdesses and princesses, according to their own fancies, and this new costumer had charming costumes to suit them. It was noticeable that, for the most part, the children of the rich, who had always had everything they desired, would choose the parts of goose girls and peasants and such like. And the poor children jumped eagerly at the chance of being princesses or fairies for a few hours in their miserable lives. When Christmas Eve came, and the children flocked into the mayor's mansion, whether it was owing to the costumer's art or their own adaptation to the characters they had chosen, it was wonderful how lifelike their representations were. Those little fairies in their short skirts of silken gauze, in which golden sparkles appeared as they moved with their funny little gossamer wings, like butterflies, looked like real fairies. It did not seem possible when they floated around to the music, half supported on the tips of their dainty toes, half by their filmy purple wings, their delicate bodies swaying in time, that they could be anything but fairies. It seemed absurd to imagine that they were Johnny Mullins, the washerwoman's son, and Polly Flinders, the charwoman's little girl, and so on. The mayor's daughter, who had chosen the character of Goose Girl, looked like a true one, that one could hardly dream she ever was anything else. She was ordinarily a slender, dainty little lady, rather tall for her age. She now looked very short and stubbed and brown.
just as if she had been accustomed to tend geese in all sorts of weather. It was so with all the others, the Red Riding Hoods, the princesses, the Bo Peeps, and with every one of the characters who came to the mayor's ball. Red Riding Hood looked around with big, frightened eyes, all ready to spy the wolf, and carried her little pat of butter and pot of honey gingerly in her basket. Bo Peep's eyes looked red with weeping for the loss of her sheep, and the princesses swept about so grandly in their splendid brocaded trains, and held their crowned heads so high that people half believed them to be true princesses. But there was never anything like the fun at the mayor's Christmas ball. The fiddlers fiddled and fiddled, and the children danced and danced on the beautiful waxed floors. The mayor, with his family and a few grand guests, sat on a dais covered with blue velvet at one end of the dancing hall, and watched the sport. They were delighted. The mayor's eldest daughter sat in front and clapped her little soft white hands. She was a tall, beautiful young maiden, and wore a white dress and a little cap woven of blue violets on her yellow hair. Her name was Violetta. The supper was served at midnight. And such a supper! The mountains of pink and white ices, and the cakes with sugar castles and flower gardens on top of them, and the charming shapes of gold and ruby-colored jellies. There were wonderful bonbons, which even the mayor's daughter did not have every day, and all sorts of fruit, fresh and candied. They had cowslip wine in green glasses, and elderberry wine in red, and they drank each other's health. The glasses held a thimbleful each. The mayor's wife thought that was all the wine they ought to have. Under each child's plate, there was a pretty present, and everyone had a basket of bonbons and cake to carry home. At 4 o'clock, the fiddlers put up their fiddles, and the children went home. Fairies and shepherdesses and pages and princesses, all jabbering gleefully about the splendid time they had had. But in a short time, what consternation there was throughout the city, when the proud and fond parents attempted to unbutton their children's dresses in order to prepare them for bed. Not a single costume would come off. The buttons buttoned again as fast as they were unbuttoned. Even if they pulled out a pin, in it would slip again in a twinkling. When a string was untied, it tied itself up again into a bow knot. The parents were dreadfully frightened, but the children were so tired out, they finally let them go to bed in their fancy costumes and thought perhaps they would come off better in the morning. So Red Riding Hood went to bed in her little red cloak, holding fast to her basket of dainties for her grandmother, and Bo Peep slept with her crook in her hand. The children all went to bed readily enough. They were so very tired, even though they had to go in this strange array. All but the fairies. They danced and pirouetted and would not be still. "We want to swing on the blades of grass," they kept saying, "and play hide-and-seek in the lily cups, and take a nap between the leaves of the roses." The poor charwoman and coal-heavers, whose children the fairies were for the most part, stared at them in great distress. They did not know what to do with these radiant, frisky little creatures into which their Johnnies and their Pollies and Betsies were so suddenly transformed. But the fairies went to bed quietly enough when daylight came, and were soon fast asleep. There was no further trouble till 12 o'clock, when all the children woke up. Then a great wave of alarm spread over the city. Not one of the costumes would come off then. The buttons buttoned as fast as they were unbuttoned, the pins quilted themselves in as fast as they were pulled out, and the strings flew around like lightning and twisted themselves into bow knots as fast as they were untied. And that was not the worst of it. Every one of the children seemed to have become, in reality, the character which he or she had assumed. The mayor's daughter declared she was going to tend her sheep out in the pasture, and the shepherdesses sprang out of their little beds of down, throwing aside their silken quilts, and cried that they must go out and watch the sheep. The princesses jumped up from their straw pallets and wanted to go to court, and all the rest of them likewise. Poor little Red Riding Hood sobbed and sobbed because she couldn't go and carry her basket to grandmother, and as she didn't have any grandmother, she couldn't go, of course, and her parents were very much doubled. It was all so mysterious and dreadful. The news spread very rapidly over the city, and soon a great crowd gathered around the new costumer's shop, for everyone thought he must be responsible for all this mischief. The shop door was locked, but they soon battered it down with stones. When they rushed in, the costumer was not there. He had disappeared with all his wares. Then they did not know what to do. But it was evident they must do something before long, for the state of affairs was growing worse and worse. The mayor's little daughter braced her back up against the tapestried wall and planted her 2 feet in their thick shoes firmly.
"I will go and tend my geese," she kept crying. "I won't eat my breakfast. I won't go out in the park. I won't go to school. I'm going to tend my geese. I will, I will, I will."
And the princesses trailed their rich trains over the rough, unpainted floors of their parents' poor little huts, and held their crowned heads very high, and demanded to be taken to court. The princesses were mostly geese girls when they were their proper selves, and their geese were suffering, and their poor parents did not know what they were going to do, and they wrung their hands and wept as they gazed on their gorgeously apparelled children. Finally, the mayor called a meeting of the aldermen, and they all assembled in the city hall. Nearly every one of them had a son or a daughter who was a chimney sweep or a little watch girl or a shepherdess. They appointed a chairman, and they took a great many votes and contrary votes, but they did not agree on anything, until everyone proposed that they consult the wise woman. Then they all held up their hands and voted to unanimously. So the whole board of aldermen set out, walking by twos, with the mayor at their head, to consult the wise woman. The aldermen were all very fleshy, and carried gold-headed canes, which they swung very high at each step. They held their heads well back, and their chins stiff, and whenever they met common people, they sniffed gently. They were very imposing. The wise woman lived in a little hut on the outskirts of the city. She kept a black cat. Except for her, she was all alone. She was very old and had brought up a great many children, and she was considered remarkably wise. But when the alderman reached her hut and found her seated by the fire holding her black cat, a new difficulty presented itself. She had always been quite deaf, and people had been obliged to scream as loud as they could in order to make her hear. But lately she had grown much deafer, and when the alderman attempted to lay the case before her, she could not hear a word. In fact, she was so very deaf that she could not distinguish a tone below G sharp. The aldermen screamed till they were quite red in the faces, but all to no purpose. None of them could get up to G sharp, of course. So the aldermen all went back, swinging their golden-headed canes, and they had another meeting in the city hall. Then they decided to send the highest soprano singer in the church choir to the wise woman. She could sing up to the G-sharp just as easy as not. So the high soprano singer set out for the wise woman's in the mayor's coach, and the aldermen marched behind, swinging their golden-headed canes. The high soprano singer put her head down close to the wise woman's ear and sung all about the Christmas masquerade and the dreadful dilemma everybody was in G-sharp. She even went higher sometimes, and the wise woman heard every word. She nodded 3 times, and every time she nodded, she looked wiser.
"Go home, and give him a spoonful of castor oil, all round," she piped up.
Then she took a pinch of snuff, and wouldn't say any more. So the alderman went home, and everyone took a district and marched through it, with a servant carrying an immense bowl and spoon, and every child had to take a dose of castor oil. But it didn't do a bit of good. The children cried and struggled when they were forced to take the castor oil, but 2 minutes afterward, the chimney sweeps were crying for their brooms, and the princesses screaming because they couldn't go to court, and the mayor's daughter, who had been given a double dose, cried louder and more sturdily,
"I want to go tend my sheep! I will go and tend my sheep!"
So the alderman took the high soprano singer, and they consulted the wise woman again. She was taking a nap this time, and the singer had to sing up to B-flat before she could wake her. Then she was very cross, and the black cat put up his back and spit at the alderman.
"Give him a spanking all around," she snapped, "and if that don't work, put him to bed without their supper."
Then the alderman marched back to try that, and all the children in the city were spanked, and when that didn't do any good, they were put to bed without any supper. But the next morning, when they woke up, they were worse than ever. The mayor and alderman were very indignant, and considered that they had been imposed upon and insulted. So they set out for the wise woman again, with the high soprano singer. She sang in G-sharp how the alderman and the mayor considered her an impostor, and did not think she was wise at all, and they wished her to take her black cat and move beyond the limits of the city. She sang it beautifully. It sounded like the very finest Italian opera music.
"Deary me,"
piped the old wise woman, when she had finished.
"How very grand these gentlemen are."
Her cat put up his back and spit.
5 times one black cat are 5 black cats,
said the wise woman, and directly there were 5 black cats spitting and meowling.
5 times 5 black cats are 25 black cats,
and then there were 25 of the angry little beasts.
5 times 25 black cats are 125 black cats,
added the wise woman with a chuckle. Then the mayor and the alderman and the high soprano singer fled precipitously out the door and back to the city. 125 black cats had seemed to fill the wise woman's hut full, and when they all spit and meowled together, it was dreadful. The visitors could not wait for her to multiply black cats any longer. As winter wore on and spring came, the condition of things grew more intolerable. Physicians had been consulted, who advised that the children should be allowed to follow their own bents, for fear of injury to their constitutions. So the rich alderman's daughters were actually out in the fields herding sheep, and their sons sweeping chimneys or carrying newspapers. And while the poor charwoman's and coal heaver's children spent their time like princesses and fairies, such a topsy-turvy state of society was shocking. While the mayor's little daughter was tending sheep out in the meadow like any common goose girl, her pretty elder sister, Violetta, felt very sad about it, and used often to cast about in her mind for some way of relief. When cherries were ripe in the spring, Violetta thought she would ask the cherryman about it. She thought the cherryman quite wise. He was a very pretty young fellow, and he brought cherries to sell in graceful little straw baskets lined with moss. So she stood in the kitchen door one morning and told him all about the great trouble that had come upon the city. He listened in great astonishment. He had never heard of it before. He lived several miles out in the country.
"How did the costumer look?"
he asked respectfully. He thought Violetta the most beautiful lady on earth. Then Violetta described the costumer and told him of the unavailing attempts they had made to find him. There were a great many detectives out, constantly at work.
"I know where he is," said the cherry man. "He's put up in one of my cherry trees. He's been living there ever since cherries were ripe, and he won't come down."
Then Violetta ran and told her father in great excitement, and he at once called a meeting of the aldermen, and in a few hours half the city was on the road to the cherry man's. He had a beautiful orchard of cherry trees, all laden with fruit, and sure enough, one of the largest, way up amongst the topmost branches, sat the costumer in his red velvet and short clothes and his diamond knee buckles. He looked down between the green boughs.
"Good morning, friends,"
he shouted. The aldermen shook their gold-headed canes at him, and the people danced around the tree in a rage. Then they began to climb. But they soon found that to be impossible. As fast as they touched a hand or foot to the tree, back it flew with a jerk, exactly as if the tree had pushed it. They tried a ladder, but the ladder fell back the moment it touched the tree, and lay sprawling upon the ground. Finally, they brought axes, and thought they could chop the tree down, costumer and all. But the wood resisted the axes as if it were iron, and only dented them, receiving no impression itself. Meanwhile, the costumer sat up in the tree, eating cherries and throwing the stones down. Finally, he stood up on a stout branch, and looking down, addressed the people.
"It's of no use your trying to accomplish anything in this way," said he. "You'd better parley. I'm willing to come to terms with you and make everything right on 2 conditions.
The people grew quiet then, and the mayor stepped forward as spokesman.
"Name your two conditions," he said rather testily. "You own, tacitly, that you are the cause of all this trouble."
"Well," said the customer, reaching out for a handful of cherries, "this Christmas masquerade of yours was a beautiful idea, but you wouldn't do it every year, and your successors might not do it at all. I want those poor children to have a Christmas every year. My first condition is that every poor child in the city hangs its stocking for gifts in City Hall, on every Christmas Eve, and gets it filled, too. I want the resolution filed and put away in the city archives."
"We agree to the first condition," cried the people with one voice, without waiting for the mayor and the aldermen.
"The second condition," said the costumer, "is that this good young cherryman here has the mayor's daughter Violetta for his wife. He has been kind to me, letting me live in this cherry tree and eat his cherries, and I want to reward him."
"We consent," cried all the people. But the mayor, though he was so generous, was a proud man.
"I will not consent to the second condition," he cried angrily.
"Very well," replied the costumer, picking some more cherries. "Then your youngest daughter tends geese the rest of her life, that's all."
The mayor was in great distress, but the thought of his youngest daughter being a goose girl all her life was too much for him. He gave in at last.
"Now, go home and take the costumes off your children," said the costumer, "and leave me in peace to eat cherries."
Then the people hastened back to the city and found to their great delight that the costumes would come off. The pins stayed out, the buttons stayed unbuttoned, and the strings stayed untied. The children were dressed in their own proper clothes and were their own proper selves once more. The shepherdesses and chimney sweeps came home and were washed and dressed in silks and velvets and went to embroidering and playing lawn tennis. And the princesses and the fairies put on their own suitable dresses and went about their useful employments. There was great rejoicing in every home. Violetta thought she had never been so happy now that her dear little sister was no longer a goose girl, but her own dainty little lady self. The resolution to provide every poor child in the city with a stocking full of gifts on Christmas was solemnly filed and deposited in the city archives and was never broken. Violetta was married to the cherryman, and all the children came to the wedding and strewed flowers in her path till her feet were quite hidden in them. The costumer had mysteriously disappeared from the cherry tree the night before, but he left at the foot some beautiful wedding presents for the bride, a silver service with a pattern of cherries engraved on it, and a set of china with cherries on it, hand-painted, and a white satin robe embroidered with cherries down the front. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Christmas Ghost and The Christmas Masquerade by Mary E. Wilkins Freeman. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.